and welcome to the Keeper Cup podcast. Chad Young and Pete Ball here with you. Now we missed one in there, and with this every other week off-season schedule, you guys probably missed us. You haven't heard from us in like a month now. I feel like the last time we talked, we were getting ready for the postseason. Fantasy seasons were just wrapping up, and now we're through game two of the World Series, but I don't know if we're quite through game two as we're recording. By the time you guys listen to this, presumably game two will be over because it's Saturday and game two, and you won't hear this till Monday. We'll be on to game three by Monday, but yeah, game two is almost over. Middle of the seventh inning, Dodgers up three. See what happens there. I'm sure you're enjoying that. I'm sure you loved last night, right? Seeing Freddie Freeman just destroy the Yankees.
Yeah, one of my former students is a Yankees fan, so I always give him grief. And what I said to him was, I'm just glad that one of these teams has to lose. Like, that's basically where I'm at. And, what I've been telling my Yankee friends is, like, it's very nice here in the World Series. I'm very happy for you, but I hope you realize within the next month, you could maybe not only lose the World Series, but also lose Juan Soto. And if you do lose Juan Soto, it's likely to the Mets. And that would just be, that would be such a perfect recipe. But no, look, the Yankees have had a tremendous season. It was a great game last night. I'm of the belief that you should never intentionally walk anybody if the next player is a Hall of Famer. And that was a crazy decision last night. Mookie Betts career 0-for-5 against Nestor. And it's Freddie freaking Freeman, man. Like, I don't know.
I have no problem with the walk.
Really?
Because, yeah. I mean, here's the thing. Like, yes, it's Freddie Freeman. It's also Mookie Betts. So, like, at this point, you've got to pitch to one of them. And I totally get that you have to pitch to one of them. And that sucks. Like, there's no good choice here. So here's my thing with going after Freeman is you put a guy in every base, so you have an easier time recording an out. You've got a guy coming up who – you've got a pitcher on the mound who is at his best more deceptive than he is a strikeout guy, which means the opportunity for, like, soft contact, a chopper on the infield, something like that, is higher. And you got a guy with a busted ankle who is not going to beat that out, right? Like, obviously, it's not what happened. But if Betts chops one to third base, there's a real good chance it ties the game and Betts beats it out. If Freeman chops one to third base, like, I don't know, the third baseman could, like, walk over to first and beat Freeman there the way he's running right now. So, like, I get it. I get why they did it. I think the crazier thing is, like, not only has Nestor Cortez not pitched in a month or whatever, but, like,
he's garbage.
He's not a reliever.
He's garbage. He's not good. Like, that hurts.
Yeah. I mean, he's a perfect, like, he had, like, a, you know, high 3.377 ERA or something this year. Like, he's a perfectly adequate starting pitcher. He is not a bad pitcher, but, like, he's not an ace. He's not a guy that you can count on being elite for a hitter or two. He's not a guy whose stuff seems likely to play up out of the bullpen. Right? It's not like he's a middling starting pitcher because he's got a nasty fastball and a wipeout slider and nothing else to go to. And so, you know, second, third time through the order, he struggles. Like, that's not his thing. Like, I don't understand. I can't fathom an explanation for why they went to him there. It doesn't make any sense to me. Someone I was talking to in the Auto News Slack was like, you know, we would have said the same thing about Gratterall coming out for the Dodgers. He hadn't pitched in a month. He came in. I was like, but that was the seventh inning where they were down one. The game was not on the line in that moment. If it went sideways quickly, they could have made another change.
And they're at home. That matters too here.
They're home. And also, they brought him in to start an inning. So it was a clean situation. And he's a reliever. So, yes, he hasn't pitched in a month, but it's like, hey, I'm going to set you up in what's effectively the simplest possible version of what you always do. Clean inning. You don't even have the pressure of holding a lead right now. Yes, you're trying to keep us within one, but, like, that's a very different level of pressure than holding a lead. And so, like, to me, I was like, I don't even think that's a fair comparison. Like, a better comparison to bringing in Nestor Cortez in that situation would have been Dave Roberts being like, hey, Freddie, how do you feel about playing center field on your bum ankle? Like, it's, we're just going to put you in this like high stress, difficult situation that you don't like. They put him out there with the bases loaded. I mean, I think he took credit for the intentional walk. Or no, did he come out? Yeah, he did. He came out, walked bats, and then pitched to Freddie, right?
I believe so. Yeah.
So, I mean, you basically said, we're going to put you out here. We're going to have you load the bases and make you come into a situation as a reliever, which you're not, where you have zero margin for error. Because if you throw a wild pitch, walk him, hit him with a pitch, anything, the game is tied. And if he gets a hit, we lose. And I just like, I don't get it.
So I do want to say, like, first of all, yes, I definitely agree with that. And I do agree that, like, logically and mathematically, I understand
the walk,
preferring Freeman, preferring the lefty. I understand all of that. But the sportsman in me is like, dude, like, you have one of the best hitters ever on deck, and it's the World Series. And you're saying to him, like, yeah, look, Mookie Betts is great and all that. We're not going to pitch him. We want to pitch to you. We think we can get you out. That's crazy to me. It's Freddie Freeman. Like, again, I understand it's a math thing and all that, but man, it doesn't look good when it goes this way, right? If it worked out well, you know, maybe we wouldn't talk about it, and that's just not fair to Boone, but I'm sure we'd talk about it. But when it goes poorly, woof.
Yeah. He had Tim Hill up and ready, like, also a lefty, had a, you know, not a great season as a reliever, but a fine season. And Hill also doesn't really give up many home runs because he gets a lot of ground balls. If you're going to put the bases loaded in order to get to a lefty-lefty matchup with a slower runner, Hill is the right guy to go to. Hill's career ground ball rate is 61.8%. This year, it was 63.2%. Last year, actually, sorry, that's his postseason, is 63.2%. This season was 68.2%. The other thing that's a ground ball significantly reduces the risk of something terrible happening, right? Like, I don't get it.
It's almost like bringing in Tim Wakefield in game 7 of the 2003 ALCS. And he gives up a home run to Aaron Boone. Definitely not an eighth of the player that Freddie Freeman is, but it does kind of feel like that.
Yeah. But let's, we got to do our jersey number thing. And we've been talking about the Dodgers and Yankees. So it's appropriate that our choice today is between a Dodger and he was a part-time Yankee. We'll see. But jersey number 53 is not a hotly contested jersey number, we'll say. There are a grand total of 2 players in the history of the game to have worn this jersey for more than 3 seasons and put up a total of more than 23 WAR. So you can't really, there just aren't a lot of choices here. And the Dodger that's on this list is Don Drysdale. He's legitimately a Dodger, played his whole career for the Dodgers, started in Brooklyn, moved with them to LA. At least I think he did. Yeah, he did, right? The Yankee, quote-unquote Yankee, on this list is Bobby Abreu, who I'm calling him a Yankee because we're talking about the Yankees. He only really played 3 years there. I think of him more as a Philly than anything else. He was also a Met and an Angel and an Astro, and I think that might be it. But Abreu or Drysdale, there, that's it. That's 53. Got to pick one of the two. So you're going to take the guy who existed in your lifetime and probably impacted your fantasy life, or are you going to take the guy who wasn't a Yankee?
It has nothing to do with him not or being a Yankee. And it was 3 pretty good years with the Yanks, even though he wasn't there very long.
Right.
But he messed me up in the Immaculate Grid the other day. The category was Philadelphia Philly who has hit at least 300 home runs. And I was like, oh, I bet, people wouldn't think of Bobby Abreu. Bobby Abreu for sure has 300 home runs. No, he has 288. So for that, for not squeezing out another 12 homers, Abreu, I'm going to go with Don Drysdale. Plus, Dodgers look like, I want to knock on wood, they're going to go up 2-0 here. So they should get the episode 53 shout out.
I think that's fair. And if they don't go up 2-0, we can blame it on Drysdale. It's obviously his fault. So.
Oh, wow. Yeah, the curse of Drysdale.
Yeah.
Kind of has a ring to
Who knew? Yeah. You know, nobody really realized that there was going to be a curse of Drysdale based on him being picked for his jersey number on a fantasy podcast. But
that's right.
It could happen. It could happen.
We'll in late October, too.
Yeah. So the other thing we usually do at the start of our episodes is we do our head-to-head heroes. We can't do that because it doesn't really make any sense because the season's over. But what we can do is talk quickly about sort of a similar concept, which is guys who have maybe moved the needle in some way during the postseason. And so guys you might be thinking about differently, looking at differently. You know, the reality is the postseason is it's chaos. It's a totally different world. There's a lot of things that are just not the same about it. But that doesn't mean that we can't look at it and see a guy that you're like, ah, I'm not, maybe this guy was a borderline keeper. Now he's definitely a keeper. Maybe this guy was borderline and he's definitely not a keeper. I think the needle does move at least a little bit sometimes in the postseason. So Pete, why don't you go first? Who do you have as a quote unquote head to head hero for the postseason?
Yeah, sure. And I want to back up what you just said, because I think there are fantasy analysts who might kind of scoff at like, oh, the playoffs don't mean anything. But I mean, like Randy Arozarena is really one that comes to mind recently, who had a monster playoff. And then what followed was, you know, really fantasy relevance. And those that have been playing a while remember David Price in the playoffs as a reliever, will remember Xander Bogaerts. And like, this is a time to pay attention and maybe get an edge. I was going to go with Gerrit Cole because I'm starting to build my confidence back up. His whip in the playoffs isn't very good, and the strikeouts still aren't quite where we want them to be, but he looked really sharp yesterday. I mean, folks, I won't lie. I'm not looking at the Statcast data on my fantasy teams like yours are over. I'm just watching the games, but Gerrit Cole looked really sharp last night. But I want to go with Tommy Edman, who was fantasy relevant for a few years because he swiped so many bags, and then he just missed so much time. And went to the Dodgers, was traded to the Dodgers still while hurt. And when he came back, I was like, all right, you know, Tommy Edman wasn't that exciting before. What's the play time going to be? Is he still going to run as much as he used to? And he did. He was running, and he was also hitting for power. You and I talked about this a while ago, and we looked at the Statcast data, and we were like, well, nothing really looks that different. So, you know, he's probably just on a hot streak. And to be fair, I'm pretty sure that's still what it is. But if you added Tommy Edman off free agency, or you got him for a buck or $2 on waivers and not new a long, long time ago, I think he's now shown enough between the playoffs right now and what he did in that brief stint in the regular season through 139 at bats that, like, I'm keeping him at that price for sure. So just so folks know, in the postseason, he's 19 for 51, 373 average. It's a 953 OPS, 2 homers and 4 stolen bases. In this season for the Dodgers, it was just 139 at bats, but he did swipe 6 bags and crack 6 homers. The average was a little low, but I think average is actually something you should expect from Tommy Edman given the speed. So he's somebody who, in this very short sample, thanks to the addition of the playoffs, I think is now worthy of consideration in your keeper leagues given his price.
Interesting. I'm still just, I don't know. I still just don't buy that he's a good enough hitter to really have fantasy value. And so I think I'm still sort of low on him. I get what you're saying though. I hear what you're saying. I understand why, like, he's been good in the postseason, and he did homer again tonight, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. So those numbers are probably not updated. That's from MLB.com. I don't think they do live updates.
No. So yeah, he's been great. Hard to argue. I don't know. I feel like we have a long enough track record with him that this, like, hot streak still just feels like a hot streak to me. So, but I don't know. The other argument in Edmund's favor at some level is, like, you know, the Cardinals gave up on him and the Dodgers decided they wanted him. And those are both votes in his favor.
At this point. I agree with 100%. So. And he is a guy who, you know, he for at least 2 years had an ADP within the top 150. And so if you're keeping him for free and he can get close to that level again, then obviously it's a bargain. If you're willing to, you know, waste a spot on him, that is.
Yeah. So my choice here, man, there are four Guardians I would like to talk about because I'm going to quickly go through the Guardians because I just want to, and then I'm going to tell you who my actual choice is because it's none of that.
Can I guess them?
Yeah, I don't know if there's actually four. So let me make sure. I have 1, 2, 3. I think I only have 3.
So Jokenzie Noel and David Fry.
Okay. So one of those is correct.
Really?
Noel, I mean, to be very clear, Noel is has given me a moment that is on the short list of my favorite baseball moments ever, right? That home run. the day of that game, I had a PTA board meeting that night, and I was, you know, supposed to be going to that meeting, and the meeting was getting close to starting as this game is winding down. And my wife was like, "Don't you have to go to the meeting?" And I was like, "Yeah, I'm just going to wait for this game to end and I'm going to go." And then her phone rang with a work call. And at the same time she answered her phone call, she hears me in the background screaming, "Oh my God, he effing did it." Over and over and over again. And she was like, yeah. And so then I had to wait until another inning happened. And I ended up being 5 minutes late to the board meeting, which was totally not a problem, but it was just I couldn't. Yeah. So incredible moment. Noel actually stunk during the postseason.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. So has for a chunk of time now. So his postseason, 24 plate appearances, a 210 wOBA. He hit that one home run. He struck out 33% of the time. He did walk 8.3% of the time. And part of his stinking was an 083 BABIP. Mm-hmm. None of that actually changes my feeling on him because I still think he's an interesting bat. I still think he's got to control the strikeouts. He's still going to be a power first guy. So he wasn't it. Fry, on the other hand, is interesting because he started off the year obviously incredibly well. Had a really bad middle of the season and then bounced back. And people, I think, missed that his August, September, especially against lefties, were both very, very good again. And then nobody missed his playoffs because his playoffs were just awesome. Fry injured his elbow early in the year, and that sort of coincided with when he fell off so bad. There's a good chance he's going to have Tommy John surgery or something in the offseason, which may delay his start of the year. It'll certainly keep him out of the field. He basically hasn't played the field in months. That'll continue for the first part of next year, most likely, until he's able to throw again. But I am more and more believing that when he cooled off after that hot start, part of it was that hot start was just unsustainable, but part of it was the injury. And I'm back to believing in him as a platoon bat against lefties. And if he maintains catcher eligibility in your leagues, which he does in Auto New and he will in some other formats, he's an awesome option as a catcher. The challenge is going to be, I think he will be a platoon bat. And so you're going to have to be a deep enough roster that you can just use him when he faces a lefty and not when the Guardians bench him. But yeah, so he's one of the three.
As you're saying that, he sounds like actually kind of an optimal catcher number two in your two catcher leagues, particularly thinking TGFBI 15 teams, two catchers. I'd love to have it platoon. I don't care as long as it's the strong side. I'm just going to give two more guesses. Then you can just tell me if I'm wrong. I'm assuming it's not Kwan because he basically just kept hitting, which he's done all year, although I guess he got cold towards the end. So I'm going to go with Brian Rocchio, who I know was hot, and Kyle Manzardo.
Yes. Kwan would have been the fourth. Because he did go cold for a little while and he had some injury issues and it seems like he bounced back and the playoff was a good reminder that he can be a truly elite hitter. But yeah, Rocchio was actually, I think, by WOBA, the best Guardians hitter across the postseason at a 396 WOBA. 400 BABIP plays a role in that, but he also walked 12.8% of the time, struck out just 17.9%. He put up a 152 ISO, which is not great, but it's a big step forward for a guy who was really struggling with the bat for most of the season. And I'll be honest, I don't even know if he's going to have a job next year. I don't know what the Guardians are looking to do. There's a lot of moving parts, but he really looked better towards the end of the season and great in the postseason. And he becomes an interesting bat, I think, as a less so as a keeper and more as a like $1 guy at the end of auctions type guy. So that's him. And then Manzardo, he had a 360 WOBA. He had a home run. He did not walk, but he also only struck out 21% of the time. I'm super excited about Manzardo now. I did that pitcher list podcast mock draft, which I don't know if, I don't think Nick's publicized any of it yet, but we're all going to be recording. Everyone who did that draft is going to be recording with Nick to talk about their picks and why, blah, blah. And I think I took Manzardo in that. I hope I intended to take Manzardo in that. Just because I want to talk about him. He's been so good. And I think he got a little bit lost. Yeah, I did take him. He got a little bit lost this year because he was slow to come up, and then he struggled, and then he came back, and then he went back down, and then he came up again. He's been really good since he came up that second time. And I think people sort of forget, like, Manzardo was an excellent prospect. Like, people expected him to be a very good hitting first baseman, and I think he's going to be. Now, do I think he's in that, like, you know, there's a tier of first basemen that are like Freeman, Olsen, Alonso, Vlad. Like, no, I'm not putting him in that group. I don't think he's headed towards that group. But I think as you look at that wide range of first basemen who come next, and there's a huge group there, I think he could be he could be a very solid option in that next tier, and he's going to be cheaper than most of them. And so I'm excited about him. Yeah. The guy I did want to talk about, though, after I just, you know, babbled about my Guardians for a little while, Fernando Tatis Jr., 7 games, only 30 plate appearances, hit 4 home runs. And I know I've been like, oh, I don't know if he's going to really bounce all the way back. In that same mock draft, I ended up taking him with my first pick. I picked 8th in that draft, and I took him at 1.8. I then, by the way, in that draft, I followed him up at 2.17 at 2.17 with Acuna. And I'm just like, boy, there's a lot of risk there. But man, if that pays off,
to play it out. Yeah.
Yeah. That's like, if that pays off, I don't even have to worry about the rest of the stuff. Like, I can just, if I have an average team for the rest of the pick, the rest of the draft, I also might have 2 of the top 4 guys in fantasy or something like that. So I'm more and more, though, coming around to the idea that Tatis will be back to being the Tatis we expect him to be. I'm still a little skeptical. We are now still talking, you know, 2-3 years. Since, like, it'll, you know, by the time next season starts, it'll have been 4 years basically since he was a 400 WOBA kind of guy, right? He had a whole year off in 2022, then he was a 332 WOBA last year, 359 this year. I think where I am coming from with him with fantasy and with that, the pick I made is I think that he is going to be, I think he's going to run more, I think he's going to hit 35 to 40 home runs. And even if the overall offensive line never gets all the way back to what it was when at his peak, I think from a fantasy perspective, he's going to be super valuable. So, yeah. But 4 home runs in 7 games in the postseason, like, that's pretty good.
Yeah, the pitching gets better. The stars rise to the top. I mean, my tune on Tatis hasn't really changed all this time. And I think he's a good example of why, when we talk about players who suffer injuries, to like look at every case individually and not just give the blanket, like, you know, he's injury prone. Some guys certainly are. And you and I have talked about that at length with Byron Buxton, who comes to mind. But in Tatis Jr.'s case, there was a serious injury to his shoulder. He dealt with it. It clearly impacted him. He then had to have surgery on that shoulder. That is a major surgery. I felt like he was really taking a long time to get his swing back. Then this year, it looks like, all right, we're over a year removed from the surgery. Now it's full go Tatis, and that's what we got. And then he suffered this weird quad stress fracture that has nothing to do with his shoulder and is a whole new injury. So like I get to fantasy managers, it's super frustrating. And I was one of those fantasy managers. I mean, keeper cut listener league number two on fan tracks. I started with Acuna and Tatis just like you did. And hopefully it goes a lot better for you in this mock draft than it did for me in an actual season. But the talent is just absolutely ridiculous. And the numbers under the hood to me suggest he's still in there. So maybe these playoffs really did catapult him back to, you know, what we want him to be and what I still think he's going to be.
Yeah. And I think the thing that's interesting is, to me, you said we had full bore Tatis until he got hurt. And that's kind of true, but he only had like a 355 or something WOBA when he went down, which is, you know, I say only like that's like an all-star level production, but it's not Tatis level production. When he came back, his first game back was September 2nd. He went 0 for 4 in that game and then took a day off and then basically went back to being an everyday player on the 4th, September 4th. Once he went back to being an everyday player, it was only 89 plate appearances, but he had a 383 WOBA the rest of the way. You add the postseason to that, and now you're looking at, you know, almost 120 plate appearances of a guy actually looking like he did before. And that's meaningful. That's meaningful. So yeah, Tatis is my head to head hero. I just made you listen to me talk about the Guardians for a little while, just because I felt like talking about the Guardians for a little while. But with that, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to turn our attention to the offseason and talk a little bit about out of new arbitration and about, generally speaking, just how to, things you need to do or you can do or you maybe should think about doing to maintain parity in your keeper leagues. All right, welcome back to the Keeper Cup podcast. Chad Young and Pete Ball here. As I mentioned before the break, we're going to talk a little bit about how things you can do to maybe keep parity in your leagues. And I think, you know, Pete, to start, I think parity, it's a word that sometimes gets a bad rap, right? And it like comes like, oh, parity means no one's actually that good. And I'm not always sure I think parity in professional sports is a great thing. You need some of it because you don't want fans to be hopeless, but you don't need, I must put it this way. The big European soccer leagues are all super successful and most of them have no parity whatsoever. And you don't want so much parity that there aren't villains, right? You need those teams that are super successful all the time to be the villains and to give everyone something to rally against. I think that's an important part of the sports landscape. But at least for me and Pete, I'm curious what you think. Like, my big concern in a keeper league or a dynasty league for that matter in fantasy, whether it's baseball or otherwise, is if you don't have enough parity and managers lose hope, you can't keep the league together. And so to me, it's a really important thing. I don't know if you feel differently, but that's my take. It's like in real sports, it's overrated. In fantasy sports, it's crucial.
Yeah, no, I mean, it absolutely is. I think most people that would listen to our podcast or, you know, checks out player pages on PitcherList and stuff like that, they probably are like, what? There are people that won't check their teams or there are people that tune out. But if you're in, you know, a dynasty league that's been going on for a while and it's just, you just keep your whole roster, look at any dynasty league that's been going on for, you know, more than 10 years. And there are just some teams that look like they should be in the literal minor leagues. And then there are other teams that look like, you know, is this a three-team league? And that's just not fun. And it makes it really challenging to balance things out. Now, I'm not judging the formats that other people play. I run several traditional dynasty leagues where you just keep your whole roster every year and, you know, nothing really changes. You just have a first year player draft and that's it. You have your roster, you make trades, you cut guys, all that stuff. But it does lead to issues. And then you have a really hard time when those teams that are disasters kind of bottom out, finding managers to run them or finding people willing to bring those back. And it can just kill leagues. And the last thing you want to do is redraft or anything like that, because the guys who put together those incredible rosters want to see their dynasty through. Right. And so that may be for you, listener, but it's not for me. And it sounds like it's really not for Chad. So I think it's important to have parity, particularly in fantasy sports, particularly as, you know, the two of us, we commission a lot of leagues. And making sure they're competitive and people are having fun is critical.
Yeah. And so I think, you know, that's where, if I go back to the you know, birth of AutoNew, the arbitration process that is going on in AutoNew right now is sort of born out of that. The original version of that was actually the vote off, which there are still AutoNew vote off leagues. Most leagues now do the allocation system. For those who aren't familiar, the vote off is basically you get two players voted off of every roster. They become free agents, but the teams that lost them to the vote can get them back at a discount at the auction. I think it's a $5 discount, something like that. The allocation system is every team gets $25 to allocate towards players on other teams that basically bumps up the salaries of those players. And in both of these cases, the idea is to do two things, really. One is, you know, AutoNew intending to be intending to sort of recreate what a real GM has to deal with. One of the things a real GM has to deal with is, like, if you have a young star, yeah, you get them at the league minimum for a couple of years and they hit arbitration. And when they hit arbitration, they get expensive, and they can get expensive real fast if they're real good. They don't get immediately up to full price, but they get pushed that direction. And that's sort of what these two systems are meant to replicate. The other thing it does, though, is it helps with this parity issue, right? It makes it a little harder to keep a true dynasty together because guys get more expensive a little bit quicker, especially the best players. And you have to make those tougher choices of who to keep, who to trade, who to bail on earlier than you otherwise would. I play in a non-AutoNew league that uses a vote off. Any of my keeper leagues use a reverse standings draft, so that if you're, you know, that's an attempt to give some parity. Anything any of your leagues do besides those kinds of things? Anything else that you've seen leagues do to try to boost parity?
I think I found my most success, and obviously I love keeper leagues. Back when we started the show, one of the reasons why it started, Chad wanted a platform to talk about AutoNew. I wanted a platform to talk about these keeper leagues where they kind of fall in between dynasty and redraft. The success I found in my keeper leagues is the less keepers, sometimes the better. You know, sometimes less is more. So in a three keeper or a four keeper, which are honestly the majority of my keeper leagues, like, there's a huge emphasis placed on, like, nailing those three or four keepers. Like, you want to have cheap prices, great players. At the same time, if you look at your roster and you're like, man, I only have two guys who are really worth keeping, you could still end up winning the league the next year. You know what I mean? Right. Like, that's a very small portion of your roster. And the other thing we do to maintain, balance in the league and parity is what we do in our Keeper Cut listener leagues, which is having the elevators for the keepers. You know, like, you may hit a home run, and I have Gunnar Henderson going into next year in my home league for a 20th round pick or whatever it is. And that's obviously a huge piece to have. But that is going to continue to go up. Whereas in the past, until ESPN changed their rules, you could just keep any three players you wanted in this league. They all cost the same. It would cost your first three rounds. Everybody paid their first three rounds. Everybody had to keep three players. So you might as well just keep your three best players. If you have, you know, escalators and reward people for finding good keepers, like this year, you know, Garrett Crochet, for example, then you're able to maintain some parity. But being flexible with the rules, for sure.
Yeah, and I think that those sort of costs, whether they're actual salaries in an auction league or whether they're draft pick costs, even if they don't escalate quickly, they make a big difference, because all of a sudden, like, you know, if you're just keeping three and it's keep any three and there's no cost associated with it, then a guy like Shohei Ohtani never enters the draft again, right? And so, even if you don't escalate a ton, even if a team could keep Ohtani every year as a first round pick, they at some point have to choose between first round Ohtani and 27th round Gunnar Henderson or something like that, right? So maybe, you know, it's a couple years out. Maybe it's next year. They pick up a late Christian Campbell, and Christian Campbell just breaks out, has a huge year. You force those difficult decisions, right? And so some of those star players, you know, they were a first round pick, and now they're only really worth a second. And if you're keeping three with no cost, you keep that guy. It's an easy choice. It doesn't matter that they used to be a first round pick. But if it's all of a sudden it's like, oh, I can keep this guy as a first rounder and he might be worth it, or I can keep this guy from the 25th round and he'll definitely be worth it, it creates more of an opportunity for those stars to get back into the player pool and back into the draft pool. And that's another aspect of keeping people interested that isn't even necessarily parity directly, right? Even if it's like, yeah, okay, I have a first round pick and I get to pick Otani, but my team's still going to suck. I still get to pick Otani, and then I can trade Otani, and then I can it gives me more of an opportunity to just sort of re-engage in the league, and it keeps people more interested. So I think, yeah, you're right. Those kind of like any kind of costs, but especially escalating costs, really help. I also have played in leagues where there's contracts that aren't necessarily escalating costs, but are just time limited, right? You can keep a guy three times, can't keep him four. And that's another way to sort of push talent back into the pool, even if you're not going to have costs associated with guys, right? So going back to that, like, keep any three you want at no cost. Yeah, Otani gets kept every single year until year four, when he has to be thrown back and somebody new gets a shot to draft him. So I think those things are, like I said, I think those things are really important. I think that without structure like that, you run the risk of people just feeling dejected and unable to bounce back. And as you said, I also play in a couple of dynasty leagues that are the traditional dynasty, keep whoever you want, keep forever, first year player draft, otherwise players aren't moving around. And if you're going to build a league like that, you need to be really sure you're building a league with people who get what they're getting themselves into, where there's relative parity among the managers, so that you don't end up in a situation where two or three teams become super teams while everyone else is falling apart. And then the two or three teams at the very bottom are just atrocious. And it snowballs because it gets worse and worse over time. And then those managers bail. And when those managers bail, you can't replace them because who wants to take over a team that has no chance to ever rebuild? Especially like you play in a dynasty league with a buy-in and you have a team that's just awful that needs a new manager. Like, what do you do? How do you tell a person like, hey, it's $50 a year, you have a shot to win money, but not with that team and probably not until 2029. Like,
I always find it funny when I'm looking for replacement managers I'm the commissioner for at least 8 leagues, I believe. So I'm always looking for guys here or there. I'll go to Reddit and I'll see, you know, $150 buy-in for a dynasty league that's been going on for 8 years and the team is terrible. Like, who is just going to hand you $150 to just take care of this atrocious team for you so that your league has a manager? Like, that's just not going to happen. And I do want to tack on one more point about the escalators and what you were talking about there, because it can also hurt in another way to not have those, in that during the season, managers can effectively make the draft pointless. And what I mean by that is, if you do have a league that's just 3 keepers or just 4 keepers, and you have these teams that are way out of it, right? And you only have 3 or 4 keepers and there's no cost associated with them. Well, if I'm way out of it, right, I have no chance at winning the league, no chance at making the playoffs. What's to stop me from trading like half my roster to secure, you know, Ronald Acuña Jr. and then trading the other half of the roster to secure Shohei Ohtani? And then I just add that to my, you know, Corbin Carroll and Julio Rodriguez. For me, it totally makes sense. I now have the best 4 keepers that fantasy baseball has ever seen, but I've just ruined the league for that season because I traded half my roster to one team and half my roster to another. And you could say that's the price of doing business. That's the game right there. Anybody else could have, you know, traded for players in your roster or made an appealing offer. I get that, but that's not what parity is. And I when I see moves like that in keeper leagues, because there are not rules in place to prevent that kind of stuff from happening, like, is that really fun? I don't know. I don't really think so. But to each his own.
No, I agree. And I think, you know, the other angle on this is like, if you're in a league that has, you know, keep three, there's also, it's really hard to buy. Because like, I've got this super exciting young prospect and I want to buy Aaron Judge off you. And the person's just like, no.
Like, yeah, why would they?
Right. And in an auto new league or even a league where, you know, the way our Fantrax listener leagues work, where there's a round cost associated, Judge may not be a keeper. Or if he is a keeper, he may be a really expensive keeper. And when you keep nine, maybe I can trade you two or three cheaper keepers to make parting with Judge appealing. So it can get, yeah. It can get ugly. It can get, I like having those things in place. And as we're talking about this, by the way, Blake Treinen has loaded the bases with one out in the ninth inning.
Oh boy.
And, yeah.
So well, he just we'll hit see what happens. Rizzo with a pitch. Yes. So that's,
on the other hand, he's got Volpe and then Wells is not the greatest hitters in the world. So we'll see. Wells actually was pretty good the second half of the year.
Do you know who the lone out this inning is and how they got out?
I don't, because I haven't really been watching.
It was another strikeout for Aaron Judge.
For Judge?
Yeah.
He's been bad.
Yeah, just, he's pulling a full Peyton Manning right now.
Yeah. It's a good thing that Giancarlo Stanton turned into Aaron Judge. To make up for the fact that Aaron Judge hasn't been here.
Some weird like Space Jam energy between those two. Like Stan totally turned into the Monstars. He took the skills of Charles Barkley and Sean Bradley and Muggsy Bogues and yeah.
And Aaron Judge.
Yeah. And most importantly, Michael Jordan. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyways, while we're watching to see if the Dodgers are going to fully implode here, let's take another quick break. When we come back, we're going to take a look at what's going on in arbitration in one of our auto new leagues. Just to talk a little bit about some players and what's happening there. So we'll be right back. All right. Welcome back to the Keeper Cup podcast, Chad Young and Pete Ball. We talked a little bit about the importance of arbitration and auto new and why it matters and why parity, why rules to drive parity matter in fantasy in general. But let's get into some specifics here. So League 1372 is the Keeper Cup listener league. Pete and I are both in that league. It's a 4x4 league. Arbitration right now has been going on for about 10 days. There's another couple weeks left. And so it's still early days. But three teams in that league have fully allocated their arbitration. And so like I'm looking here and I'm seeing my $9 Ellie De La Cruz is now $11. My $19 Logan Gilbert is now $21. My $21 George Kirby is now $23. My $21 Teoscar Hernandez is now $22. My $24 Pablo Lopez is now $25. My $14 Riley Green is now $15. And I'm sort of fascinated by some of these arbitration decisions. Cause like, I know Teoscar Hernandez had a really good year. I know people are still high on Pablo Lopez, even though he didn't necessarily have a great year. I didn't expect either of those guys to get hit with arbitration. So I'm sort of surprised to see both of them get hit with a buck. The rest of this, Kirby and Gilbert were both excellent. Ellie De La Cruz has been insane. Riley Green might be the one that bums me out the most because I thought that with the other talent on my team, he might dodge any of this. And I really like him at a $14 keeper. It doesn't change at $15, but if he gets another few bucks and gets pushed up closer to $20, it won't cause me to cut him, but it will cause me to be annoyed. And so that's sort of where I am on that. Have you looked at what went to your team and any surprises or any thoughts on the allocations to your team?
Yeah. So I had $2 to Michael King, which I think is interesting given our conversation about playoff performers. You know, he had that, I think he had two starts and one of them was absolutely brililliant. So I wonder if that had to do with not just $1, but $2 being tacked on to Michael King, taking him from $9 to $11 and with, you know, and Chad, has inflation already hit these players?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So yeah, he's going to be $11 as of right now. Bybee, another guy who looked pretty good in the playoffs. He had a buck added on. Yainer Diaz had a buck added on, which I really like Yainer Diaz, but I got a pretty good catcher situation here. So he's going to be interesting. And Jaron Duran has gone the most up for my team. He's had $3 tacked on. He was six Now he is 9, which is still a slam dunk keep for the superstar top 5 MLB player, Jaron Duran.
He's going to get more, I am sure. The other guys here, it's sort of interesting. Like, I'm a little surprised by Bybee, but only a little bit. I'm a little surprised by King, but only a little bit. Yiner Diaz is an interesting one. And I think one of my favorite things with auto new arbitration is when a guy like Diaz gets arbitration assigned to him. As you noted, you've got Diaz, you've got Salvador Perez for $5. That's it. It's just those two. You only have two catchers. You don't have that great a catcher situation. But if you don't feel like you need to keep both of them in a month, 3 weeks, whatever it is, when this is all done, you're going to be able to see who put that dollar on Yiner Diaz and, you know, call him up and be like, hey, you thought he was undervalued. Let's talk trade. And I think it's one of the underrated fun things with auto new arbitration is you are both bumping up the price of players on other teams and also getting a very clear signal from a bunch of other managers about who on their team they like, who on your team they like the most, which can grease the skids for some off-season trades. So if you're feeling good about Salvi, Diaz could be you're going to get some info on who to trade Diaz to. So looking across the other allocations that have been made in this league, anything that jumps out at you?
Well, I was going to say one other thing that surprised me with my team so far. Sure. And granted, not everybody has done this yet. Like you said, it was only 3 teams or something like that. I guess I'm a little surprised, and maybe I'm being a homer, that nothing has been put on Roman Anthony yet, just because of, I mean, look, recent prospects have not had a lot of success, but he's now the number one prospect on MLB Pipeline, and I'm willing to bet, if we look at the last 3 to 4 years, whoever that was, whether it was Wyatt Lankford or the year before that, whoever it was, I'm willing to bet almost all of them ended up costing more than what I currently have Roman Anthony for. So I guess from the, and Roman Anthony isn't the prospect that Wyatt Lankford was, to be fair, but that does seem to be it. Like, I've had dollars added to Marcelo Meyer in the past in this arbitration process, in this very league, actually. So to see nothing on Roman Anthony is, I guess, a little surprising. I'm not inviting people to. Please don't take that as like, oh, okay, I'll put some on. I'll gladly keep him for $3. But I think there's a pretty decent chance he's up by the end of April. He is the number one prospect in baseball. He was having a fine year at Double A, and then he got called up to Triple A and just lit the world on fire. 162 WRC plus. His walk rate was equivalent to his strikeout rate. He's ready to go. So I'm pretty excited about Roman Anthony, both as a Sox fan and a manager in this league. So to see no arbitration on him, I guess, is surprising, but I guess there's some other good options there.
I'm not surprised, only because this has been a topic of conversation in Auto New Slack, is that the prospect pool right now isn't that exciting.
Yeah.
Right? There isn't a Lankford or a Churio out there. There's not a Gunnar Henderson or even a Jackson Holliday. Like, there just isn't. And
but there is. There's a Roman Anthony.
Yeah. Sure. Whatever you want to tell yourself, Pete. No, I like Anthony. I think he's a good prospect. I think he's I don't know that I agree he's the number one prospect. I know you're citing Pipeline. Like, I don't know that I would make him my number one prospect.
I'm glad you said that. Not Pipeline. It's I think it's Baseball America. I don't know who Pipeline has number one.
Got it. Well, whatever it is, I think the bigger thing is right now he's standing up near the top of a pretty unimpressive group, which isn't to say that this group isn't going to produce just as much value over time as last year's or the year before's. But like, I think sometimes people get caught up in this idea that like, oh, the last couple of years, the top prospect has been a guy I'm willing to spend $15 on. And so therefore the top prospect is a guy I should spend $15 on. And like, that's not true. And so from my view is like, yeah, there's a good chance he's up early in the season. I think there's a good chance he becomes a good player. He is more of a run-of-the-mill good prospect to me than he is a Lankford or a Churio or someone like that. And therefore, I don't see him in that $10, $15 camp. And so I'm not going to put arbitration on him. He's just not a guy that I'm going to target. So I'm not super surprised by that. By the way, while we were discussing that, this is another moment where I'm not really sure I get the decision making from Aaron Boone, because that after Volpe struck out, Roberts went to the lefty Vesia, and Boone pulled Wells, which I understand pulling him there, but for Trevino, who isn't really a threat to do anything to the baseball ever. And so I am just, I am again just wondering why. I know it's to get away from the left on left, right? They're playing the platoon advantage. Wells might run into one. Dodger Stadium is not a hard park to hit a home run in.
I'm going to sound like an old man. Like, why do we need managers anymore? Just let ChatGPT do it. If you haven't used ChatGPT, it's incredibly impressive. I use it once a day for something random. Like, if that's all it is like, oh, here comes lefty. Now I must have lefty come in. Like, you chose Trevino over Wells. What are we doing?
I like that you said, I'm going to sound like an old man. Why don't we just use ChatGPT?
That's fair.
All the old people sitting around the retirement homes right now being like,
what?
Why aren't we using more ChatGPT?
But you know what I mean. You know what I mean? Like, why are we such slaves to this now? Like, let Garrett Cole go higher than 88 pitches or whatever it was. Like, let Blake Snell finish the World Series. What are we doing? And I'm somebody who, Jesus, I have a podcast with you on Pitcherlist. Like, I'm on Statcast all the time. I'm not opposed to analytics or anything even remotely close to that. But what are we doing intentionally walking someone to pitch to Freddie Freeman? Aaron Boone should be fired if they lose the series.
Trevino was better this year than Wells versus lefties. So maybe I'm making more of a thing out of this than I should.
No, I'm glad you said it. I'm glad you said it.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. Anyways, getting back to arbitration here. I am now pulling up your team, and I'm going to start doing some arbitration on your team right now. Because you mentioned Anthony, and I was like, no, I'm not going to give money to him. So I look at your roster, and the first thing that jumps out at me is
on Will Wagner.
Well, Duran is obviously a target. I do like King, but Bybee, Diaz. Like, I start looking at your expensive guys. You have some fun players, Yordan Alvarez and Vlad Jr., but like, they're both up over $50. I don't think they need to go any higher. $48 Corbin Burns, no. Simeon at 42, no. Austin Riley at 40. Is getting closer, but still, I think I just don't see a need to make him 41, 42 bucks. $25 Christian Yelich. Okay, $22 Glass now. Now we're getting interesting here. Man, you have a $15 Bowden Francis. I saw his name. I was like, oh, that's a guy I might want to put some arb on. I could say $15 Bowden Francis. No, sorry.
Hey, $7 Josh. Someone else went 14, so.
Yeah. $7 Josh Lowe is interesting. Your inexpensive players are for the most part not super obvious targets. Like, you go to the bottom of your roster and like I may put a buck on Tanner Houck. I like at $3, it's probably worth pushing him up a little bit. He's an obvious keep. But then like Kyle Finnegan, Ryan Nelson, Porter Hodge, Sir Anthony Dominguez, Nick Gonzalez, Scott Barlow, DL Hall, Michael Garcia, and then you get to Anthony. Matt Chapman at $4 is maybe the next most interesting sort of cheap guy on your roster in terms of being a target. I don't really see it. And so I end up back near the top, and I think what I'm going to end up doing is putting $2 on Duran, which takes him from, he was at 6. He'd already gotten pushed up to 9. This will push him up to 11. And then I think I'm going to put the $3 on Tanner Houck, because I am going to put $3 on your team. The only other thing I'm thinking about with your team right now is like, do I want to signal something right now? It's like, I could, instead of putting dollars on Duran, who I think everyone's going to notice, do I put a dollar on your $22 glass now or something like that, just to like make sure people notice him and think about whether or not he needs to be pushed a little bit. But for now, I'm going to do $2 on Duran and $1 on Hauk. Are you sad? Are you feeling miserable?
No, I'm fine with that. They got to go somewhere, and they're going to go to players I'm probably going to keep. I guess one other name that's interesting to me, and I guess this exercise kind of proves it, I just feel like this guy is like the most forgotten player in baseball, is Marcell Ozuna for $6 was probably like my best player other than Vlad this year. Someone did put a buck on him, but if I can get him next year for $7, absolutely. Sign me up.
I think the thing with Ozuna is, for me, is he is util only, which limits his value, and that is not likely to change anytime soon. He is as great as he was this year and last year, for that matter. He was pretty unimpressive for 2021 and 2022, and he's going to turn 34 years old basically any day now. Before arbitration is over, he'll be 34. And that's not to say that he's, you know, old and therefore toast and like, but if I put a dollar or two on him now, the chances that a year from now you're like, whatever, cutting him anyways, are just a little too high for me. I prefer to put those dollars on a player who I think, like, I want you 3 years down the line to be like, those dollars Chad put on my team are still bothering me. And I just think that's way less likely with Ozuna than it is with Duran or Hauk.
No, that makes total sense. People fear the Red Sox. That's what I'm going to take away from this.
That's the lesson here. I think the lesson might be that you have all the Red Sox.
Which is very weird for me. Like look at my other teams.
That team?
What's that?
You've Cutter Crawford on that team.
I got Crawford, right? Hauk, Duran, Marcell Mayer, and Roman Anthony.
Yeah.
And I feel like there's one more. Kenley Jansen, who kick rocks, buddy. Like,
fair enough.
Knock your less. Yeah. Yeah.
You got all the Red Sox, but yeah.
Yeah.
Why don't you take a look at my team? I'm curious where you're going to land.
Sure. So scrolling through, I'm definitely jealous of the $3 Spencer Arrighetti, but I've scrolled through it, so I'll go through what my mindset was. At the top there, $51 Mookie. I don't need to add anything to that. Logan Webb, that guy after this year, I never want to see his name again. I don't care to add arbitration. I want you to keep him for $29. Please do. I don't want to do that to you and add dollars to such a terrible pitcher. Lopez at $25 right now. Someone added a dollar. That's good. That's good value, but it's not enough for me to press the panic button yet. It's more
I want to just quickly mention that Pablo Lopez's ERA this year was like, so where did Webb go? I had Webb here a second ago. I was just looking at him. His ERA is more than 0.6 higher than Webb's. Like,
yeah, and Pablo Lopez struck out more batters in one inning than Logan Webb did all year.
His home run per nine is more than 0.75 higher.
Still don't care.
It's not so much that I think that you're wrong to prefer Webb to prefer Lopez over Webb. I get that, but like, Webb was the better pitcher for this format this year.
But the story with Pablo Lopez is what the hell was going on for the first few months of the season.
Sure.
I think looking at seasons in totality is the right way to do it. But I think for certain players in certain situations, we have to look at more than just what were the final season statistics. And I don't think it's a fair assessment of Lopez and Webb. And I'd be willing to bet Lopez goes ahead of Webb in standard 5x5 leagues next year. This is not a standard 5x5 league. I understand that. But I think the home runs per nine and the ERA for the season makes it look like Webb is better, but I don't think so. Especially also considering this is arbitration and Webb right now is $4 more than Lopez.
Yeah.
I would rather have Lopez anyway. So, I don't mean to upset Giants fans. I don't actually hate Logan Webb. I traded for him in a league and he just turned into like a bum. And so he bothers me.
In that mock draft, the podcaster mock draft thing I did, traditional 5x5 Yahoo head to head setup. Pablo Lopez was the first pick of the 7th round, which puts him at pick 73. Webb was the first pick of the 9th round, which puts him at pick 97. So they're like 24 picks apart, basically. They were exactly 24 picks apart because they were exactly 2 rounds apart. I can do math. But that doesn't account for the fact that in the format we're talking about here, home run per 9 is it's a quarter of the stats, and Webb is way, way better in that and will be every year.
He will be. He keeps the ball on the ground very well, but this year was kind of a weird standout year in terms of that being a bad stat for Pablo Lopez. I mean, it's been on the rise for 5 straight seasons, but that's if we're counting 2020, he was giving up 0.6 home runs per 9. So like that's a pretty high bar to start from, but no, like I don't think Lopez is going to be some weakness next year. I even in this format, I'd rather have him than
Lopez was over 1.2 home runs per 9. 2 straight years at the start of his career in Miami, like even in Miami in that part.
Yeah, but I mean, at this point,
then it dropped down to that 0.6, like you're saying. And then since then, he's been 0.96, 1.05, 1.11, 1.26. Even if you think he's going to be around that like 1.1-ish number, which would be good for him, it'd be one of, you know, middle of the road for his career and a big improvement for him. Like, for Webb to be anywhere near that would be a disaster for him. Like, other than his rookie year when he made 8 starts and was 1.13, his worst season was last year when he was 0.833. And other than that, he's been mostly around 0.5. Like, Lopez is going to give up twice as many home runs as Webb. That's just going to happen. And so I think for this format, I realistically, I don't think these two guys are all that far apart in this format, if far apart at all. And I think if I had to pick at the same price, and I understand we're talking arbitration, they're not the same price right now. At the same price, this format, I would take Webb.
Yeah, I mean, look, looking at those two statistics for this year, home runs per 9 and ERA, and yeah, obviously home runs per 9 is a massive strength for Logan Webb. I get it, but like, I don't know how much worse the season could have got for Pablo Lopez, and he still finished with a noticeably better whip than Logan Webb, on top of the fact that you're getting probably like 30 more strikeouts from Pablo Lopez. Like, to me, it's not a slam dunk. And again, we're looking at Lopez on the heels of one of his worst seasons since he became fantasy relevant. Not to say that's not the same for Logan Webb. I just think Lopez has the skills to stand out and that Logan Webb has the skills to kind of regress more to the mean than be this like top 10 pitcher that people were drafting him as going into this year. So I have a very different flavor in my mouth for those two pitchers. Needless to say, that means I will not be adding dollars to either of them.
Right.
Your Mariners are the ones that stick out to me in Logan Gilbert and George Kirby. But I just see this $9 Ellie De La Cruz, who's now at 11, somebody added 2. And I just feel like I can add 3 to that. And those $3 will continue to stick for a very, very long time. And then I can revisit this later in case Ellie gets really slammed and then target those Seattle pitchers. I think that's where I'm at. Like, I was looking at the bottom. I may have mentioned this earlier. I saw Aaron Geddie for $3 is a pretty nice get. So you know what? That's what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna add $1 to Spencer Aaron Geddie because you know I like Spencer Aaron Geddie. A $4 Parker Meadows. I love Meadows, but even at $4, I don't know. Bradish for $6 maybe at some point is nice, but not in the foreseeable future. So yeah, I'm gonna add $2 to Ellie, $1 to Spencer Argetti, and I'm going to let the rest of the league hammer Gilbert and George Kirby.
Yeah. I'm this league. I've got those two Mariners starting pitchers. And then my offense is surprisingly Tiger heavy. I have Riley Green. I have Gary Carpenter. I have Parker Meadows. I have Spencer Torkelson, and I have Colt Keith. And I think they're all probably keepers. So I'm a little unsure what to do, because I feel like I don't want to be starting five Tigers every day. But
in years past, no. But hey, I don't know.
I just look at those guys and good. Like,
when they face the White Sox anyway.
Yeah, Green is up to $15. I think he's an easy keep. Kerry Carpenter at $8, I think, is an easy keep. Parker Meadows at $4, he'll probably go up a little bit from there. I think he'll be an easy keep at $5, $6, whatever it is. Torkelson and Keith are the tougher ones. I think a $6 Keith, he finished the season pretty strong, and so I'm pretty intrigued. And but Torkelson was good after he came back too. I don't know. I may have to make some trades this offseason just to de-tigerify my team.
Yeah, because I think, all things being equal, I'm keeping all five of those guys at those prices. So if it is a thing that you just don't have that many Tigers, I think trade is the way to go, because I couldn't see myself cutting any of them.
No, and it's not a good park to hit in, and all of them, the outfielders less. So I feel pretty good about the outfielders, but both Keith and Torkelson have some risk associated with them. And so I think part of it will depend on like what does the rest of my team look like. Like if I'm keeping Keith and Torkelson, but they're not guys I'm relying on, then maybe I'm okay with that. Maybe I'm okay starting three Tigers in my outfield if the rest of my team is not reliant on them. But yeah, we'll have to see. I think what you're doing though makes sense. I think that the league is going to hammer Ellie anyways. And I think you make a good point that like you can come back later, and if they don't adequately hammer Ellie or don't adequately hammer my Mariners starters, you can come back and deal with that at a later date. So, but I do think this is a situation where my, you know, Ellie De La Cruz started this process at $9. He's going to end up at like $25. He's going to get hit hard, and he's going to protect a lot of the rest of my team. And yeah, Ellie, man, I wish he got on base at a higher clip, because in this format, his good but not great on base percentage caps his value a little bit, only a little bit, because he also scored 105 runs, hit 25 home runs. Like as a shortstop, he's putting up good numbers. But yeah, Ellie, spend some time this offseason working on that on base percentage for me. So, all right. Well, I think we've covered everything there is to cover on this topic. Hope you guys enjoyed listening. Hopefully by the time we get together for our next episode, we're going to have a World Series champ to discuss, and we'll be deeper into offseason. Arbitration will be almost over, so we have a little bit more time to talk arbitration one more time. But don't forget to hit us up on Twitter at Keep or Cut. That's Cut with a K, at Chad Young, at Pete B Baseball. You can also find us in the Slack, the Auto News Slack, in the Pitcher List Discord. If you got questions, things you want us to cover this offseason, stuff you want to hear us talk about, let us know. And yeah, thanks for listening. We'll be back with you in 2 weeks.